You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 6th, 2021, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So how is everyone doing on this lovely Wednesday? Not much happening in the world today. It's kind of a slow day. Slow news day.
January 6th.
Sedition.
Yeah, there hasn't been any attempted coup.
Yeah, by the time our audience hears this, they'll already know what pretty much came out of today. But right now, we are literally dealing with the insanity that happened in the U.S. Capitol. You know, my feelings on the whole thing are the U.S. is in big trouble. We have a big, big problem here. And I don't see a solution other than people just giving it up. You know what I mean? Like, the fight seems to just be starting.
I don't know. I mean, it was an interesting thing. I think Van Jones said it on air today, but I saw one of my friends had retweeted it with a little quiz and said, is this the beginning of something big, or is it the end of something very
right,
bad?
Right, that's the question.
And in my view, I think this is just a desperate death grip on power that is very swiftly being removed from the hands of those who are committing these terrorist acts.
Yeah, I tend to agree with Kara. I think that, and this is ultimately a sideshow. It's ultimately going to be ineffective, but it's dramatic enough that there may be an actually effective backlash against this ineffective show of force that we're seeing. It's still disheartening. It's disheartening for the world to see, you know, American democracy in flames like this, you know. I do think the thing is, though, I mean, it doesn't come down to one man, but it sort of does. But it's one man and his co-conspirators, enablers, whatever you want to call them. I know that whatever you call them, no one's going to be happy about it. But, you know, the people who are supporting what he's doing, I think we're just not going to be able to. It's one of those things that we won't really know what the effect is until 1 minute after noon on January 20th when we turn the page. And then we'll see what things are going to be like going forward.
Yeah, you know? Is the dust going to settle? But you're right, Steve. I think at least the good thing that comes out of this really dark day is that it's so beyond the pale what happened today and what's continuing to unfold that people who were on the fence are being forced to disavow it.
Right.
And are finally stepping up and saying, I see now that I've been sitting a bit on the wrong side of history.
Yeah.
And like, it's a commitment now. This is no longer a passive thing. I'm going along with it. If you don't stand up and say, this is not right, this flies in the face of the principles of our democracy, then it's pretty clear to everyone else.
Yeah. We literally got an email today from an SGU listener who apologized for previously criticizing us for criticizing Trump. He's like, I guess I see it now. And that was really, really dumb of me.
That was like 2 years ago, right? When he first wrote to us.
But still, he's like, it's like, I can't stand by any of that anymore. Yeah. It's just a little example, I think, of the effect. Let's turn a little bit to COVID. I know we're not going to continue this every week update on COVID anymore, but there are a couple of things we have to talk about. Okay. So last week we talked about the fact that there was a new variant, the Kent variant, which came out of the UK, and that this variant is more infectious. It's not more deadly, doesn't cause a worse infection. It's just more likely to spread, but by about 50 or 60% by some estimates. And it's quickly becoming a dominant variant wherever
especially
it goes.
Yeah,
because it spreads more easily.
For obvious reasons. Yeah.
But did you guys hear that there's a second new variant?
Yes.
We actually brought that up last week, the South African variant.
Yeah, the South African variant.
Yeah, so the South African variant was already around when I did this story last week, and we mentioned it. But what we didn't know yet was that there's a concern that it will not be responsive to the vaccine.
Yeah, that's the new bit. It has some of the same mutations in the Kent variant, which makes it more infectious. So it's also more infectious. But it also has mutations that allows it to evade antibodies that are targeted towards previous variants. Now, this means a couple of things. One, it's not immune to those, right? So it's not like the vaccine won't work at all, but it's not as effective. So number one, the vaccine may not be as effective. Instead of being 95% effective, it'll be less than that. We don't know what the number is going to be, but it'd probably be a little bit less, maybe significantly less. But two, it can infect people who were previously infected with COVID more easily.
Oh, what the hell?
So
your own immune response won't be sufficient.
Won't be as protective as other variants. So I wrote about this again on Science-Based Medicine today to get everyone up to date on these two variants, but also to put it into context. This is yet another risk of allowing a pandemic to simmer along over long periods of time.
Right.
Mutations are inevitable. Different viruses mutate at different rates. This is something I didn't learn until today when I was researching it, that the coronavirus has error correction mechanisms when it replicates. So that's why it mutates more slowly. It actually is able to to correct the copying, you know, of the genome. But if an infection in an individual or an epidemic or a pandemic simmers on long enough, you're still going to get mutations. So part of the problem is just that there's so many people are infected for so long. There's just an incredible number of opportunities for new variants to arise. And there are thousands of variants. You know, that's most of the variants are roughly equivalent because most mutations are going to be either completely neutral or just not consequential. But, you know, we keep rolling those dice and now we have two new variants that are worse, you know.
And significantly more mutated, too. That's the interesting thing, too.
Like, well, yes, that's correct.
They're so much faster than the background rate of mutation.
That brings up the second point. So that's a good point, Kara. So it's not just that, it's just that this mutation happens to be bad. The Kent variant and the South Africa variant have a suite of mutations that seems to have come all at once, much faster than the background mutation rate of this virus. And they think that's because in an individual patient who had the infection for months because we were treating them, right? Which, of course, we have to do. We're not going to let people die. But if we're treating somebody so that they will survive, but with an active infection for months, that just gives
it's
a selective pressure, and it gives the virus an opportunity to accumulate a whole bunch of mutations. So that's what they think happened.
Yeah, I remember when I did the story last week that was like a working hypothesis, but it was not well established yet. But it's so fascinating that we can see the same sort of viral fast mutation like we have demonstrated so many times in the lab with antibiotic resistance, you know, with bacteria mutating and being able to skirt, playing kind of whack-a-mole, you know, and be able to skirt the meds that we make, to see that happening in a viral population so quickly in what we now know is a massive reservoir of virus. So many people have it.
Which is another reason why, as a public health measure, it is important to socially distance, wear a mask, you know, avoid exposure, get tested and isolate if you've been exposed, et cetera, et cetera. And also get vaccinated when you can.
We have
to shut down this epidemic, because if we don't, we're playing Russian roulette with the virus. You know, we're giving it more opportunity to spread and to mutate and to turn it into harsher forms.
Once we get to herd immunity, which will not happen through natural infection without killing a way bigger portion of the population than any of us would ever be ethically comfortable with. That's why the vaccine exists, to get us to herd immunity fast. And once we get to herd immunity, the likelihood of having these resistant mutations popping up all over the place, it just plummets. We got to get to that point.
One bit of good news is that there have been a number of studies over the year looking at how long does immunity to the virus last, and there was mixed results. But the latest information is that immunity following an infection lasts for at least 8 months. That's good.
That's really good. Okay.
Yeah. And it's not just like one aspect of immunity, but it seems like all of the aspects of immunity last for 8 months. And it could be longer. So that's just like at least 8 months. Hopefully the vaccines have similar profile, that, you know, we're hoping that it will get at least a year of immunity out of a single round of course of the vaccine. But the other thing is, you know, if new variants emerge, like the South Africa variant, where the vaccine is less effective, we may need to get vaccinated every year, just to keep up with new variants.
Just like the flu. Yeah, yeah. Just like yeah, the flu.
But hopefully that will slow down. And again, I'm hoping that the vaccine antibodies will last longer than a year. But
Well, and I'm also hoping that it won't be that hard logistically because we're using an mRNA vaccine.
Yeah, they literally made the mRNA vaccine in 2 days. And
yeah.
And if it's sort of like that vaccine infrastructure is approved, just doing another slight variant of it mm-hmm. shouldn't take a year, you know, of testing. It should just be like, okay, yeah, you tweaked it, fine. It's everything else is the same. You know, you could sort of approve it very, very, you'd fast track that. So we should be, just like we do with the flu vaccine every year, we don't, you know, start from scratch approving the flu vaccine. It's the same.
They might already be doing that, right, in South Africa. Like research labs might already be trying to develop a new mRNA vaccine.
We know it's a new variant because they sequenced it. They just have to get mm-hmm. that, you know, and that sequence is published. Moderna is probably already making a vaccine for it. You know, that's all they need is the sequence. That's the beauty of the mRNA vaccines. Mm-hmm.
But I wonder how ineffective is the vaccine against it? I mean, is it 94%? Maybe it's
yet.
You know, maybe it's 75%, which is still not bad.
No, it's not bad.
It's probably something like that, I would guess, from the preliminary evidence we have. It's probably 60, 70%, something like that. But we don't know for sure yet.
It's a function of the speed of scientific innovation clashing with the slowness of public health initiatives.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, we can keep up with this scientifically, but it's kind of, it's not moot, but it's frustrating that if we can't get people vaccinated in a timely manner, the actual virus might mutate out of control. And that vaccine that we've been working so hard to distribute is no longer going to work.
Yeah. The science isn't going to save us if we don't have our political act together. And I think, you know, the World Health Organization put out a statement not too long ago, essentially saying, you know, the COVID-19 is not necessarily the big bad pandemic we've been warning you all about, and we've been
warm up.
This may be a warm up. Yeah, this may just be a wake up call that this is on the spectrum of pandemics. This was not that bad, you know, of potential pandemics. I mean, and not historically. And imagine if we have one that's 10 times as worse, you know, where the death rate is an order of magnitude worse. That's completely plausible. And so we have to use this as a dress rehearsal for an even worse pandemic that may come, and it probably inevitably will come in the future. Yikes. These pandemics are coming faster over historical time.
But don't forget, I mean, it's not like we'll have another 100 years, like, because it's been 100 since 1918.
No.
Or even 50. Or maybe it'll be 50. But wait.
Every decade.
But I mean, how about, or maybe sooner than that? I mean, if you have this stuff that's targeted for people, I mean, imagine people making this on purpose. That's a real worst case scenario, because they could purposely make it many, many times more virulent.
Yeah, but even that aside, even, you know, biowarfare aside, just naturally occurring, you know, just because of the nature of our global economy and the number of people in the world, you know, this is what's going to happen. We're going to get periodic pandemics, and some of them are going to be bad, and some, you know, maybe worse than COVID, you know. So we have to get our act together. We have to make sure that this doesn't happen again. And this was mainly, this is a scientific success, but a political failure, all things considered. Some countries did a good job, obviously. New Zealand did a great job.
Yeah, that's from an American perspective.
Yeah, yeah. Sure. But, well, I think, you know, yes, definitely from an American point of view. I think from a Chinese point of view, early on, they flubbed the beginning of it. Other countries didn't do a good job. We need to have a coordinated international effort and response that doesn't allow something like this to happen again. That's the bottom line. Okay, let's move on to some news items. Bob, you're going to start by telling us about canyons on Mars.
Wait, I thought it was canals on Mars.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Canali.
The most detailed images were recently released of the largest canyon known, Valles Marineris Canyon on Mars, is the largest canyon in the solar system. And the latest images from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter show it in amazing, unprecedented detail. It seemed like I was inundated with links for this week. I just kept seeing them. And then so I started checking them out. It's really beautiful, the details. And, you know, looking at these, thinking, wow, these are, you know, pictures are actually on Mars. Now, back to the Earth, though, I've never actually seen the Grand Canyon, which is kind of a travesty.
You weren't with us when we saw the Grand Canyon?
No.
I didn't see it either.
I hear it's pretty awesome.
Oh, my gosh.
And it's big. I mean, it's like definitely huge, 445 kilometers long, 28 kilometers wide, a little over a kilometer deep. This is big. It's just really big, but seems kind of insignificant now after I read about the Valles Marineris Canyon. Oh, my God. This thing slices along the Martian equator, 2,500 miles long, over 4,000 kilometers. This thing would extend across and beyond the entire United States. 18 miles and or 29 kilometers wide. Incredible. So that's 10 times longer than the Grand Canyon, 3 to 5 times deeper than the Grand Canyon. I would love to see this. Screw the Grand Canyon. I want to see Valles Marineris Canyon. Let's see. I got to get my Astamaz. So now the images that I think it was the University of Arizona recently released, as I said, were quite striking. But the real hero here is the camera on the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. Remember that? That thing has been out there for well over a decade. The camera is called HiRISE for a High Resolution Imaging Science Experiment. And it's basically the most powerful camera ever deployed to any planet. This was specifically designed to get a lot of detail to give you a sense. Let's see, pixel size from an altitude of 300 kilometers is about 12 inches, 30 centimeters across. Overall image size is a width of 6 kilometers and can be programmed to have an image length up to 60 kilometers. The smallest resolvable feature in the images are about 3 feet. The camera operates in mostly invisible wavelengths, but also near infrared. So this thing really, it's a beast. I think it's like 5 feet long, 150 pounds, something like that. Now, since the canyon's discovery in the 70s, scientists have wondered, well, how did this canyon form? And they're not sure. They really can't say this is how this canyon formed. You look at Earth's Grand Canyon, any grammar school kid will tell you that it was carved out by flowing water. Took a really, really long time for water to do that, but it was water. But the Valles Marineris was not created that way, and that's because the Mars environment simply cannot support something like that happening in that way. It can't support a river large enough to slice through the crust like that. Now we know that water, of course, flowed at one time on ancient Mars, so possibly it helped enlarge Valles Marineris, but it didn't create it. Now the European Space Agency thinks that their theory is that a large portion of the canyon probably cracked open billions of years ago. Now, because you know what's nearby this canyon?
Olympus Mons.
The Tharsis region is nearby, which is a nearby group of volcanoes, which includes, of course, Olympus Mons, which is the biggest volcano in the entire solar system. So this is a quote from the European Space Agency. As the Tharsis bulge swelled with magma during the planet's first billion years, the surrounding crust was stretched, ripping apart, and eventually collapsing into the giant troughs of Valles Marineris. It's an amazing area of Mars. I highly recommend checking out the images online and seeing the beautiful images from HiRISE. Check it out, guys.
And Bob, it could not have been water because of the sheer size of it. Is that the conclusion?
No, just the environment of Mars itself. It's very dry. It's very hot. There's 1% atmospheric pressure. So given an environment like that, and it's been that way for quite some time, you're not going to be able to carve. You're not going to be able to support flowing liquid water on Mars.
Even billions of years ago.
Well, yeah. See, even billions of years ago, because I think I discussed a couple years ago the loss of the Martian atmosphere was due to the lack of a magnetosphere around Mars, and you know the solar wind just wreaks havoc with your atmosphere, and that's why it's so thin. And it's been that way for quite a while. So mm-hmm. they say that if you look back in time, the environment wasn't good enough for even water when water could exist on the surface for periods of time. It still wasn't good enough to carve something this big, you know, maybe something much smaller, perhaps like the little Grand Canyon, maybe, but not this behemoth.
All right, Jay, tell us about the Scientific American article about the ethics of the brain-machine interface, one of my favorite topics.
Yeah, this is called neurotechnology. I mm-hmm. love that. I love whenever they add a word in front of the word technology, like because it's creating a genre. You know, it's like it's now neurotechnology. So in the science fiction genre cyberpunk, which some of you should know about, you can connect a brain or somebody's brain to a computer, right? That, you know, in cyberpunk, it's called slicing, or, you know, there's lots of words for it, but slicing is like, you know, you kind of have like an interface where you go in like Tron and you do stuff in there like that looks physical. Really cool stuff. Some people in cyberpunk universe, in any cyberpunk universe, they have implants that let them plug in. You remember like Neo in The Matrix, you know, that huge thing that got put in the back of his head. The potential of this technology is, of course, it's profound. So think about it this way. It's a way to connect a person's nervous system to some kind of computer. The computer would be able to collect and interpret or infer or even modify information that's created by any part of the nervous system. Right? This is called a brain-computer interface. So you think, you know, you plug in, what's happening? You know, what is actually happening? Well, your brain, which is, you know, which sits on top of every nerve in your body, and, you know, your brain and all of those nerves are your nervous system. Being able to talk to a brain or have a brain talk to a computer is that interface. It is neurotechnology. In the short term, researchers believe that this technology could help people with mental illness or neurological disorders. And of course, there are endless other ways to use the technology. You know, God, entertainment, gaming, you know, education, gaming, you know, lots of things. Gaming is on the list as well. It'd be pretty amazing to do gaming, you know, with a neural hookup. Right, guys? Kara?
Hi. I love the gamings.
Yes. gamings is amazing. I know. Mm-hmm. I love it.
It's like the sweet sport. Spot. I enjoy it like the sport.
So what would a neurotechnology or neurotech for short actually be? So one version of it is it's a brain-computer interface where there are tiny electrodes that are placed on or even inside brain tissue. This would allow a computer to not only detect neural activity, but even change it. So early versions of this technology, they can help people that have Parkinson's disease, epilepsy, and in some cases, chronic pain. Back in 2017, someone who was a paraplegic used neurotech to drive a remote control car with his thoughts, right? Wow. That's really cool, right? So apparently, you know, electrical signals from his brain were being read by a computer, and that computer interpreted those signals correctly to steer the car the way that he wanted to. And even more profound, someone that had these brain implants had imagined hand gestures of writing, and the computer was actually able to interpret that imagination into legitimate text. And it was in real time with similar in speed to real typing. You know, what do people type words per minute type of thing? It's like, you know, that's legitimate. That's not a joke. That happened. With our current technology, researchers have also been able to make people who are missing limbs to feel touch in varying temperatures through their prosthesis. So, you know, the beginnings are already here, whether you know about it or not. You know, scientists are pouring a lot of time and attention into this. And, you know, so many applications are right in front of us that we could see. And a lot of them we can't see yet. So another version of this technology is an external wearable. And today we have very early versions of it that can help with pain management and also detect a person's intentions, like to speak or to move. And I think that's fascinating. You know, your brain, even when you're thinking, I want to speak, or I want to move, your brain is doing something in that initial intention, even before your body moves, something is happening in your brain.
Even before you're aware of it.
Right. Yes. It's not even on the conscious level. It's happening before you even know your body's moving. Insane.
Although, you know, it's predicting what you're going to do based upon this pre-conscious activity in your brain is only about 60%. So it's only a little bit better than a coin flip. And the question is, why is that the case? You know, especially if it's something simple, like, are you going to choose the left choice or the right choice? And the thinking is that you make a choice at a subconscious level, but then you consciously can reject that choice. You know, it kind of depends on what state your mind is in. So it's complicated, and we haven't really fleshed it out completely yet.
In the future, this technology would allow people with communication disabilities to communicate much easier. And I think that's quite obvious and probably an early use of it. So the technology is advancing very fast, and it can have profound positive and negative effects. What I'm about to tell you is both remarkable and a bit scary. Researchers at Columbia University were able to record the brain activity of a mouse that was performing a particular action for a reward. And at a later time, they were able to activate the same neurons that they recorded and made another mouse do the same actions on command.
What?
Press a button, mouse number two does exactly what mouse number one did because they fed it into its brain.
How did they do that?
So was this a motor thing? Was it just a movement?
How do they feed it in? That's the question.
Jay, you know what that reminds me of? That one part of the Animatrix where they show the robot studying the interface of the human brain and like how
making him laugh
it.
And cry.
Yeah, yeah. Oh,
you don't want that.
Great scene. But they had his brain. That's what I think this might be. They had the brain splayed open and it was like activating, you know, certain areas. We could do that now. We've done that for. We could probably do that for years and years. This is different.
Right? Do you think that we're going to develop a mouse matrix where mice will live entirely in a virtual world of our making?
No.
Clearly
not.
The mouse matrix, it'll happen as it'll be an incredible research tool.
Oh, Kara, it already exists. And they're
this
out
is not
there.
The matrix.
No, seriously, Kara, sure? They're Are using so them sure? for batteries. It's disgusting. So listen, so another team of neuroscientists, guys, I'm not done. Like, you got to hear this. No. This is going to even
How are they
creepier.
Activating the neurons?
So another team of neuroscientists were able to actually copy and transfer a learned task between two different rodents. So they're able to implant, you don't want to say false memories. They were able to implant legitimate memories and learned behavior into another rodent.
That's crazy.
So I think in a way, this technology is similar to artificial intelligence. So as the technology advances, we're going to need very, very well thought out regulations and ethics that have to be anticipated before the technology is here. And there are many ways this technology can threaten someone's privacy. It could also threaten an individual's autonomy, you know? And guys, it's going to happen, right? Like, you know, as much as it could be 5, 10, 15, 20, however many years, it's going to happen. We're already seeing massive, you know, improvements in this technology. It's no longer something that people go, oh, you know, maybe someday, you never know. Like we're saying, yeah, we're on path to do it.
Yeah, but this is invasive, right, Jay?
Well, it's like the wearables are not invasive.
But I'm saying what they did with the mice.
Are they using magnetic fields or optogenetics? What? What's the method of?
Well, so the answer is that you could use a multiple different methods. The more invasive, the more detailed at this point in time. But as the technology progresses, we'll be able to get higher and higher resolution, whether we're reading or writing, with less and less invasive techniques.
Well, we can't read anything at the cellular level right now outside of the skull.
Outside of the skull? No.
Yeah, we can't. Maybe the writing in terms of, like you were saying, Bob, there may be something we could do with like, what is it, MEG like magnetoencephalography. There may be some things that we could do maybe with external electrodes, but there's no way they would be this specific. But we can't read what's happening in your brain.
No, not yet. Not yet. Not like that. Like not in the science fiction way yet. But I guess the point here is just you know, I find this so interesting. I mean, I love it. From a fan of technology, this blows my mind, you know. But you know, from someone who has developed very detailed ethics as I became a skeptic and as I, you know, as I get older and I think more about the meaning of life and, you know, autonomy and privacy issues, which, you know, a lot of people deal with today. This is one of those things. Now, let me give you another, for instance. So most of this neural data that is generated by a person's nervous system, it's unconscious. Like Steve said, you don't even know what's happening. Right. So as an example, if someone were able to put a wearable device on you that could read your neuronal activity, you wouldn't even know that your personal information, thoughts, memories, you know, whatever is being recorded or stolen, because you don't feel your brain think that way, right? You're not like, oh, something's accessing my brain or doing something. So I know this sounds like science fiction, but this kind of technology is actually on a foreseeable horizon. And
I don't know if I agree with that. I don't know if that will ever be possible without an implant.
Wait, Kara, but even with an implant, I'm just saying as a for instance, I'm not saying if that's going to happen because the wearable thing is like really, really, you know, that's.
Well, Kara, it's a matter of resolution. We can read brain activity with external devices.
We can, but not in a way that we can actually map out a well-established neural network and know which cells are firing and recruiting and where.
No, right, but not now. And it is.
It's theoretically possible.
It's an open question. Yeah, that's the thing. It's an open question, like what technology would be necessary. But here's the thing, Kara.
Yeah.
What if, you know, having a device attached to your brain with 1,000 microwires, which already exists as a technology, the microwire part, it becomes common. And then we have to worry about people hacking into
your connection. Yeah, that's the question. Once the technology exists, it could be
hacked.
Like Jay, you're talking about. Yeah, it could be used nefariously. But it still requires, I think, at least for the foreseeable future, and I'm talking multi-generations, it requires that the person whose brain it is receive some sort of implant or some sort of device.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I just don't see you being able to scan somebody's brain without their permission unless they already have a device present that allows for that.
But I agree. This is not like on my short list of urgent problems that we need to solve, but I do agree that as AI progresses, as neural interfaces progress, as we merge with our technology, the philosophical, ethical questions that we have to confront are going to get increasingly profound in terms of, like, where's the demarcation line between what is a person and what isn't a person? And what rights do we have in terms of our neural privacy and the right not to have somebody, you know, mess around with our neurology, et cetera. And, you know, and it's more like, I think it's pretty obvious that those kind of things would be crimes, but I guess it's more of, like, you know, how severe should we consider them as crime?
And also, like, what about from a medical perspective? You know, we've gone from, it's not been that long since we had a fully paternalistic medical model, mm-hmm. you know? And so, like the ethics, sure, yeah, it's a crime if some rando person wants to take your thoughts and then, like, sell them, you know? Or take your thoughts and then, like, use them to commit a crime or whatever. But what if the medical establishment utilizing this ability to help you, but without your consent, like, that really, the ethics gets so sticky.
Yeah, I agree. That's where it's going to be. That's going to be the ethical issue. Oof. Up front. I mean, I tell you, it's obvious if somebody kidnaps you and neuro-rapes you, that's a crime. But if it's going to be more like, what if we could rewrite your synapses to treat your depression? Is there a line where you're actually changing somebody enough that, are you neurologically killing them because they're not the same person anymore?
And also, what if the reason you're doing it is because they're in a position where they can't tell you that that's what mm-hmm. they want or don't want because they're so sick?
Yeah, I think that's where, again, therapeutically, at least initially, is where it's going to get complicated first.
And that's also where it's going to be utilized first. Exactly. Yeah, totally. Evan. Yeah, that's the real horizon of this kind of treatment where we would be using implants.
Mm-hmm. Jay, did the article talk about, you know, you guys are focusing on the one side of the double-edged sword of this, and we need to do that. But you mentioned something about learning. What else did they expand on that? Are there other, like, the good side to this coin, a really good side to this coin? I mean,
I spent a lot of time on that. I mean, there is a ton of awesome things that they could do with this type of brain computer connection. You know, it could help people that have diseases. It could help people that can't communicate well. It could help people.
When it matures.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, once we hack our genetics completely, then we could fix anything genetic. You know, once we really hack the brain machine interface fully, you know, the brain then just becomes something that we can alter, at our will. We could reprogram it. Absolutely. And then the real ethical conundrum is going to be, like, are you treating depression or are you tweaking your personality? And is it okay? What if I want to change my personality? Do I have the right to do that? Or are we over-medicalizing, then certain personality traits?
And in some ways, it's an extension of the same arguments that we've been happening in psychology, philosophy, and medicine when we first had, antipsychotics come on the market, when we first had trepanation, when we first had frontal lobotomies, these different things that's like, ethically, are we making a new person? What is the line? Like, how do we define identity and personhood? And is mental illness, if we look at it from a fully medical perspective, which I don't, is it a disease state or is it a syndrome?
Yeah, how about this, Kara? What if somebody gets convicted of a crime and a psychological evaluation determines that they have psychopathy, they're a psychopath, and they are offered an option, you could spend the rest of your life in jail, or you could allow us to cure your psychopathy by changing your brain permanently.
Right.
Is that something that is ethical to even be on the table to rewrite somebody's neurology?
Oh my gosh.
And you're even talking about it as a choice. But what if we look back to, like, what happened to Alan Turing?
Well, yeah.
Where they were like, you're gay, that's
horrible.
Aberrant. We will treat you for your gayness by basically chemically castrating you. He did not have that choice. And I could see that being a real ethical conundrum.
That was tragic.
you have psychopathy, you're a murderer, or let's say you're
a
child abuser, and we have a treatment available for you, but it will change who you are. And this is what we're going to do.
Yeah, and then putting that in the hands of a country like China. You know,
Of a country like ours today.
Well, but no, Kara, there's a difference. That's not true. That's not true. I think that there's a fundamental difference. There are some authoritarian countries that will go far beyond, I think.
Oh, for sure. Like North Korea, obviously, is the most extreme example. But you're right. I mean, and I say that sort of tongue in cheek, but also like I always want to remind myself that I'm only like one sort of or two bad luck scenarios away from homelessness or away from catastrophe. And I think, you know, we have to sometimes remember how tenuous things are. Things aren't great here right now either. Yeah. I don't think we'll become North Korea anytime soon, but I don't, you know, I do think that we have to be at least mindful of that.
Yeah, but these are all the reasons why we need to really progress ethically and morally so that when we are confronted by these really challenging technological advancements, that we're prepared for it. And I'd rather be overprepared and prepared way earlier than necessary than even a little bit too late.
And because we have a bad history of being reactionary instead of proactive.
Oh, for sure. And Jay, I think some of the reason that my response comes out the way that it does is because although it's exciting and fantastic to think about these things in wild sci-fi terms, I think it sometimes disconnects us from the actual reality of the threat. And when we can describe them in terms of true existential threats, like realistic existential threats, I think that we as human beings might be able to be more engaged with the concern. When I can see this as an eventuality and not just a fantastic maybe thing that's in the far-flung future that requires all sorts of crazy technology, then I might be more invested in thinking about it from an ethical perspective instead of
Kara,
putting it in a box. I like the royal eye. I'm talking about people.
It depends on what sci-fi you're reading, to be honest with you, because it's not all far future fantastical. A lot of it is like really one or two steps removed from where we are right now and very realistic and very pragmatic, like having implants that are used therapeutically for psychiatric reasons that then get exploited or abused, for example.
Sure, I didn't mean sci-fi in the sense of an actual book. I meant like, as Jay was presenting the story, when we present it in a way that's really fantastic, like somebody scanning from outside of your head versus going into the hospital where somebody already has the implants, then all of a sudden that realism comes
That's closer.
Yeah. And then that's when you go, shit, this is scary.
Kara, can I tell you something important?
Yes, please.
If you ever find yourself homeless, as long as I draw breath, you will always have a place to live.
I love you, Jay.
I mean
that's
it.
That's really sweet.
You just don't even think about it. Just get over here. I got a room. I got meatballs. I got it all.
I've been in that Connecticutian basement. I've slept there. It's got a super comfy mattress.
Yeah, you'll love the winters.
You could live in the SGU studio.
I could.
Surrounded by a green screen.
There you go.
You guys are like, we'll make a nerd of you yet.
Oh, yes. There's a space
all right.
in the corner. You can have that.
Guys, let me ask you a question. Do you guys have a preferred learning style?
Yes.
Oh, isn't that debunked?
Totally. It's 100% bullshit.
I was like, man, I don't think so. That's not a thing.
Good job, Kara. So, but there was a recent study that looked at the percentage of people in education. These are people the field of education who believe in the learning style paradigm.
So
how high would you imagine it is?
70%. 70%.
Yeah,
80%.
Maybe even more.
So it depends on the study. The aggregate, if you review all of them, it's 89%.
Yeah.
But some of them are as high as 97%. So it's bad. Now, let me back up a little bit so our audience is keeping up here. So learning styles is the notion that individuals differ in their preferred way of consuming information. One of the more popular ones divides up the world into people who are visual learners, auditory learners, kinesthetic learners, or read-write learners, people who like to read and write. And they say if you're an auditory learner, then you will do better if you consume information in an auditory format. It's never been true. There's never been evidence to support it. And after a couple of decades of research and multiple systematic reviews, et cetera, there is no evidence to support this notion that people do better in their alleged preferred learning style. And in fact, if you like, give somebody a test to determine what their preferred learning style is, they don't necessarily even prefer that learning style that the test
says. Oh, really? Not even prefer.
So it's not even a subjective thing.
Yeah, they might not. In other words, and not if you ask them, it's not like if you ask them what's your preferred learning style, they may say the same answer. But if you, like in an unrelated context, give them an option, they won't choose the medium that fits with their alleged preferred style any more than average.
Well, it just bolsters the idea that not only are there not learning, like that learning styles don't actually equate to better learning, but also that even what we think is a better learning style doesn't equate to better learning.
So yeah, just the preference itself might not even really exist, let alone that it provides an advantage to learning outcomes. It doesn't. It's just, it was, you know, I guess a semi-reasonable idea as a hypothesis 40 years ago or whatever, but it was never really robust and it was never evidence-based. But for some reason, it became totally entrenched in the education culture. And it just is one of those myths that refuses to die. There are numerous systems of tests, and you know how I hate these tests, you know, where you try to divide up humanity into like a single digit number of types, because mm-hmm. People just are not that simple. And in here, I think the big problem is that there's a premise in there that is just false. The study involved 18 countries. This is a worldwide phenomenon. This is not just in the West or just in the United States. This
it's
is
not culturally
pretty much everywhere. It's and it also has not been diminishing over time. It's very stable. It has not declined in recent years. A recent sample of trainees, this is education trainees, found that 95.4% of them were still learning the learning style paradigm. So this is baked into education. Some good news is that this is one of those myths that is modifiable with the knowledge deficit model, that if you just give these educators information about the scientific evidence, studies that have looked at this found that on average you can decrease their belief by up to 37%. So that's a pretty significant drop. Yeah. So
it
that's
is, yeah, but it's not good enough.
No, I don't know. It should be 100%. You know, it's like, here's some facts. You know, so and when I've confronted people on this, you know, they often respond with anecdote. You know, that's the sort of the go-to. But I've seen it work, you know.
It's like, yeah, but how do you confront them?
It works for me.
Yeah, do you confront them in an auditory way or a visual way?
Yeah, Steve. Maybe you're not going with their preferred mode.
So.
Steve's rolling his eyes so hard right now.
What does matter? So, and this reminded me when I was reading about this, Richard Wiseman, who will be making an appearance on our 12-hour show in 2 weeks. Richard Wiseman, who wrote the book 59 Seconds, the premise of the book is that there is a ton of psychology research out there that can actually help you improve your life. Mm-hmm. And the self-help industry is built upon none of it. It's built upon myth and nonsense is ignoring the actual information about how to improve your life. The same thing is true. There is actual evidence-based methods for improving education outcomes, but they get displaced by the mythology of learning styles.
I think it's really frustrating when there's crossover, right, Steve?
Yeah.
Like when you have academic psychologists writing self-help books, and like some of it is totally legitimate, other ones are totally wooey, some of them are halfway in between, and so it gets watered down, like the entire field gets watered down.
Yeah, totally.
Ugh,
so all right, so the premise is wrong, and it because the truth is that people will consume information based upon the information itself, right? So some information is visual and is optimally conveyed in a visual medium. So it has to do with the information itself, not the learner. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And in fact, the best way to consume information is multimedia.
Yeah, through all your senses. Like try your best to consume it multiple ways.
Yeah, so multimedia, there's some advantage there, and also matching the medium to the content. That's the most important thing. Match the medium to the content, right? So like you're listening to a podcast right now. We actually form, you know, the things that we do and talk about so that it's conveyed optimally through an audio-only content. Right. And we just talked about the fact that we're going to be doing a video streaming event, and we're going to do some bits that have a visual element to them, that because we can't do them on a podcast. Mm. But it's just about you match the information to the medium, not the person to the medium. That's the bottom line. But there are other things that, so what's the harm? What's the harm of the education world persisting in this mythological belief in learning styles? Obviously, it's distracting energy and time and effort away from things that could be more effective. So for example, we know that the timing of the exposure to information is important. I don't know if you guys knew this, but if you want to really learn something effectively and efficiently, then you need to expose yourself to it multiple times at increasing intervals, right? Yeah. And this is something that's frustrated me about classroom learning. It's like, you know, the year, the semester should be designed around that model because we know that it works. People should be going back to information they learned at the beginning of the year to remind them of it. Otherwise, it's this endless sequence of information that you're forgetting.
Well, really, it should build upon itself.
Yes, exactly.
It should be foundational, and then you add to that and add to that and add to that.
But always going back and reinforcing the previous information at intervals, because that interval training works. But the education system rarely takes advantage of the actual information about how to optimize learning. The other thing that it does, so instead of displacing more effective techniques, it's actively harmful. And for example, what it does is it pigeonholes students. So imagine you're a student who takes some bogus, stupid test and is told you're an auditory learner. That actually will keep you from optimizing your learning strategies, right? Matching the content to the medium, and also may discourage you from pursuing courses or subjects that are more visual, right? And also may frustrate you as you're trying to, you know, pigeonhole your learning strategy into this narrow, ineffective, you know, strategy. And so in that way, it actually is not only displacing effective methods, it's doing active harm. So
it's almost like a stereotype.
It's a stereotype. Effect. You get stereotyped. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. And you stereotype yourself. You know, it's just like astrology. Like you think, oh, Leos are supposed to be this, so I'm going to be this way. It's like, no, but that's all bullshit. And so why are you living your life based upon nonsense like that? It's a self-imposed stereotype that just becomes dysfunctional. So it really needs to be purged from the world, you know, just the education culture. We need to find some way to get the word out and to really purge the whole notion of learning styles. It's done. It's failed decades of research. It's actively getting in the way of improving our learning outcomes. I do feel that it's part of a deeper problem. I don't think this is an isolated thing. I think there is a deeper disconnect between what's happening in the trenches in education and education research. I think at the high, and I've been at pretty much every level of education as a student and as a teacher. And what I see is at the highest levels, the information's being, the people who are like doing the research on education outcomes absolutely incorporate that into their teaching and pass it on to those around them. But as soon as you get even one step away from education researchers, then there's a total disconnect between the research and what's happening. And
I think that happens in a lot of fields too.
Probably. Yeah, probably.
Even in medicine. I mean, that's why science-based medicine matters so much.
Yeah.
Because there's a disconnect sometimes in biomedical science and then the practice that's utilized over the years. Some people, especially if they're in like remote practices or they're not connected to a large university hospital or something like that, they just kind of stick with doing it the way they did it. Luckily, you have to take continuing education, but
And there's evidence to support that, totally. The longer you are out from your education, the more likely you are to deviate from the current best practice recommendations, for example. But we recognize that that's a problem, and there are institutional mechanisms to fight against it, like continuing medical education, for example. And you have to re-up all of your certifications expire now. They used to be lifelong. Now, every 10 years, you have to re-up them, and that involves documenting all kinds of methods to try to make sure that physicians are keeping up to date. It still needs to be more, but there's a lot of infrastructure there for teachers. And I'm sure they get some kind of continuing education as well, but that infrastructure needs to be more robust so that, there's absolutely no reason why 90% of teachers believe in teaching styles. That should have been beaten out of them a long time ago.
Yeah.
So clearly there's something that's not happening here. But also I've had a lot of interfacing. As anyone who has paid attention to their children's education, and I have now through college, there is nonsense in the educational system at every level. I've encountered it all, even at good schools, even at, in parts of the country that have lots of resources and that are considered to be top tier in terms of public education. There's so much nonsense that and pseudoscience that is just baked in. That's really disappointing. It's like, really, seriously, you're still pursuing that paradigm? I mean, come on, that is, 50 years old. They're still doing scared straight stuff, for example.
Oh my God, that's ridiculous.
And it serves as a massive...
We know that doesn't work, though.
Yeah, we know
that
it doesn't work.
Same thing with how
we treat
addiction and, drug abuse in children. Like, they're still doing these troubled teen boot camps and things, and we know those don't work. I mean, it's pretty terrible, the damage that can be done.
Totally.
Especially during these critical periods of development when pseudoscientific techniques are utilized.
Oh, for a person who is, say, dyslexic, does that not count? In other words, would a dyslexic person not have a preferred style of, saying, not reading, going a different direction?
Yeah, that's a good question, and that's a different situation because there you have somebody who has a very specific neurological deficit, right? Mm-hmm. So people who are dyslexic, by definition, they're just at the very low end of the bell curve in terms of their reading ability. And so reading, you have to learn to read before you could read to learn, right? And so if you have a real deficit in reading, then that may not be the best way for you to consume information. Totally.
Yeah, because to be clear, a reading disorder, any type of learning disorder, is defined by having an average intelligence and, let's say, an average ability to do other aspects of your academic enterprise and a specific deficit only in that area.
Maybe not
an average intelligence, but I should say a relative deficit to other things. So if somebody has a reading disorder, like you said, they clearly have a problem with reading and either reading only or reading and the other deficits that they carry. Yeah.
But that's not a learning style.
Okay.
That's
not a learning style.
That's a deficit. That's like saying, well, if you're blind, you can't consume video. You're right. That's the same thing.
The audio portion.
It's just it's a more obvious example, but it makes the point. That's a deficit. That's not a preferred style.
And then as far as people, why they believe in this, do you think it has to do with a person's sense of individuality? In other words, it helps them define who they think they are, and therefore they're likely to want to grab a style and make it theirs, make it their individual trait?
Yeah, I think so. I think, and we've talked about this before, why do people love astrology, right? People love to talk about themselves. They love to label themselves. And it's also a simplistic system. I think anytime you impose simplicity on complexity, people like that as well. Yeah. So I'm going to give my students a test and then I'm going to label them with their learning style. And that's going to give me a leg up on teaching them. There's something very compelling about the simplicity of that. I think that's why we love these personality tests. Like what kind of person, like what was the Myers-Briggs.
Oh.
Like, that's never going to go away. It's total bullshit.
I think it speaks to the fundamental attribution error. Yeah. It's much easier for us to say, well, it's because I can't learn that way than it is to say it's because this situation was not conducive to my learning. We have this tendency when things go really, really right to be like, it's because of something I did. And when things go really, really wrong, it's because of something they did. And so the thing about education and the thing about learning is that it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard. And so when we feel like if we don't have more of that kind of growth mindset and that's not fostered from a younger age, and instead we just tend to give up when things get hard, then it's very easy to justify why we stopped trying or to sure. justify why that other thing felt, you know, easier than this thing that felt hard. Oh, it's just because that's not my learning style.
All right, Evan, tell me that birds are smarter than monkeys.
No way. Wait, monkeys
in
are
this
apes.
Case, in this case, apes.
Ooh, no the way.
The argument, the debate continues. Yep, we're revisiting this decades-old debate, what we affectionately refer to as monkey versus birds. When scientists at the University of Osnabrück and the Max Planck Institute of Ornithology, that's cool, they have recently reported on some interesting studies involving ravens. Their studies have suggested that ravens develop cognitive skills relatively quickly and are near to complete by 4 months of age. So that's it. By 4 months, the cognitive performance of ravens may be similar to that of adult great apes. Now, I know monkeys are not apes, okay? You can spare us the emails. We use the term monkey versus birds loosely. Kara, for you and others, it's a long-running, fun term we occasionally harken back to from the days when Perry was on the show. So we appreciate the latitude.
Yeah, the short version is that Perry incorrectly asserted that monkeys were smarter than birds. It also came down to who would win in a fight. And I said, come on, if you have a raptor...
Right.
Like a raptor, we just pick up that monkey and drop him, you know. And he insisted that the monkey would win in a fight.
But then, Steve, remember they found a you know, like an early
a skull,
chimpanzee skull that had eagle holes in it.
Yeah,
it was like an eagle's nest,
punctured.
Yes,
giant eagle, you know.
Perry's argument with that monkey would take that bird and beak flip.
Yeah, Yeah, for me, I always think go to the extreme. So I'm thinking a terror bird against a gigantopithecus.
Mm-hmm.
Got to give that one to the terror bird.
I think so.
Yeah. Well, we've talked several times about studies that have come out ever since then. And yes, birds are fascinating and very intelligent animals. Now, this particular study, their findings are published in the journal Scientific Reports. And the title of it is Ravens Parallel Great Apes in Physical and Social Cognitive Skills. The lead author is Dr. Simone Pica, who said recent studies suggested that members of a songbird family, corvids, evolved complex cognitive skills, but a detailed understanding of the full scope of their cognition was, until now, non-existent, and that relatively little is known about their cognitive development. So they took some ravens, 8 of them, in fact, hand-raised, 4 months, 8 months, 12 months, and 16 months of age. I imagine 2 of each, although I didn't specifically read that, but I guess that would equal 8. Now, the researchers analyzed the ravens' performance in experimental tasks. They test their understanding of the physical world, and they looked at how ravens interacted with other ravens. As they described in the abstract of the study, the researchers fine-tuned one of the most comprehensive experimental test batteries called the Primate Cognition Test Battery, or PCTB, and they applied it to raven features. This afforded the researchers a direct quantitative comparison with the cognitive performance of 2 great ape species, namely chimpanzee and orangutans. Now, guys, have you heard of this PCTB before? The Primate Cognition Test Battery?
Mm-mm, that's cool. So it's like a psychological test for primates?
Yeah. I tried looking it up, and although I could find references to it, I really couldn't find an example of what it was.
Yeah, that's if it is like a psych test for primates, you're not going to, because those are like protected legally.
Really?
Yeah, because you have to be trained to administer them, and the test companies make a lot of money on the protocols, so you're never going to be able to like just find reproduced pages from a WACE, for example, like an intelligence test online. There's copyright issues around that.
I like looking for these things because I want to know if, you know, I look into it a little bit to see if there's anything, you know, maybe a little sketchy going on or some people have some criticisms of it, but there's very little. But it seems to be utilized right, and so, considered standard.
So what you can do, just so you know, Evan, is you can search within the literature, like in PubMed or like at Google Scholar, wherever you search, and use the word validity in your search. So the validity of the, what's it called, the PT?
PCTB.
Yeah, validity of PCTB. And then you'll find studies where people are either confirming its validity or questioning it or both.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Thank you for that bit of advice. I appreciate that. All right, so back to the study. The skills the authors investigated included spatial memory, the understanding of relative numbers, addition, and object permanence.
Cool.
Now, object permanence is the understanding that an object still exists when it's out of sight, right? You hide the, like a shell game kind of thing. So they said, for instance, to investigate whether ravens know where food is located, they hid treats under a cup and moved it quickly back and forth among other cups that were empty, the shell game, effectively. And the raven selected a cup by pecking or pointing at it with its beak, while a chimpanzee would have done so with its finger. So this is how they made the test normally for primates and turned it into a raven test. They study reports that the cognitive performance of ravens was similar from 4 to 16 months of age, suggesting the speed at which the cognitive skills develop is relatively quick and near to complete by 4 months of age. They compared the cognitive performance of the ravens with those of 106 chimpanzees and 32 orangutans who completed similar tasks in a previous study. And they found that with the exception of spatial memory, the cognitive performance of the ravens was very similar to those of the primates. Wow. So there you have it. That's a bit of bird versus primate news for you.
So, but I do feel compelled to point out that, and we've talked about this previously on the show, you know, intelligence is not one thing, and bird brains are organized differently
than primate brains.
And so it's kind of, it's an apple and orange kind of comparison, but it might be that, you know, birds have the wiring for this kind of problem solving, especially corvids, but that doesn't mean that they equal apes in other ways in terms of neurological function.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like dolphins are the same thing. Dolphin brains are very different than ape brains. And even though they're big, they're wired for echolocation and things like that, and they have some problem-solving skills as well, but they don't have the same level of intelligence in other ways. They don't have the same brain organization that primates have.
But the interesting thing is, Steve, this test was developed for primates, and birds still did well.
I do think, though, it happens to fall into the sweet spot of what corvids can do.
Yeah.
And so we can't extrapolate beyond this test is what I'm saying to like some kind of overall intelligence.
You can never do that anyway. We talk about that a lot in psych research where it's like, you know, this person is performs well on measures of this. That's all
say,
you know.
But it's especially true when you're comparing differently organized brains. Yeah.
So I had to go down a bit of a rabbit hole. We're talking about ravens.
Good.
And when you think about ravens, what do you think of?
Birds. Nevermore.
Yeah.
Poe. Yes, Steve. Very good. Okay. And what's one of the famous lines from that
Nevermore.
Famous Edgar Allan Poe?
Nevermore.
Treatise. Right. Nevermore. But what's the words that come before
that? Oh, quoth the raven.
Good, Carrie. You got it right.
Yeah, it's not a crow. It's a corvid, but it's a raven.
But you said quoth.
Yeah. He says quoth. Yeah.
Q-U-O-T-H. Yeah. Whereas I, most of my life, heard it as quote the raven, or I've heard other people refer to it as quote the raven.
That just shows you that I'm like way more gothy and emo than you are, Evan.
Well, is that what that means?
I think that just means I read a lot more Poe when I was a teenager.
Have you guys ever heard people say quote the raven?
No, I haven't. I've always heard it as quote.
Yeah, but I've also never listened for it, so maybe I was filling it in. Maybe I did hear people say quote and I didn't notice.
Could be.
So, Evan, is there a difference?
Yeah.
It means something different?
It does mean something different. Quoth specifically has to do with a third party telling you what another party is effectively saying. Did I get that right?
Weird. So it's like a
so and specific to this particular right.
It's also archaic.
Only in first and third person singular before the subject. Well, the tide is going out, quoth the sailor. Right? So you're talking about what the sailor was talking about.
But I think it's also specifically designated as archaic.
Yes.
Which is how I always thought of it. It's like it's Poe. Yeah, it's just archaic.
But it is interesting that
almost an affectation.
That you wouldn't, because you wouldn't say quoted the sailor. You would quote the sailor, but you would say said the sailor. So it's sort of like quoth is more like in modern times how we say said the sailor.
Yeah.
The tide is coming in and out.
Yeah.
And Steve, it says here, not only is it archaic, but you can use it also if it's a humorous context, mm-hmm. it would be appropriate.
Well, you can use it anytime you damn please.
That's right.
Quoth, Kara.
You're a quoth.
I'm going to start using that all the time now. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. So let me ask you guys a question. Is there anything familiar about that to you?
Yeah, you played it last week.
Or the week it before. Does sound a little bit household. Does that
That's
make sense?
Interesting. Yeah,
like
it does.
Like
it
a
does.
Garbage disposal. Like something
sounds like
you've
white
heard
noise.
Before.
A appliance of some
yeah,
sort.
Yeah, yeah, like a Vitamix.
All right, well, a listener named Eli Steger said, Jay, I believe the noisy to be a swarm of drones programmed to perform, to create images and shapes in the sky, right? Like a light show in the sky. Very cool. Many people guess that. Many, many people guess that. That is not correct, but I happen to be a fan of those drones, like the coordinated drone things. I think it's really, really cool. I'd love to see it in person. Another listener named Michael Blaney said, hey, Jay, not Bob. The first noisy of the new year sounds like a bunch of snakes reminiscent of the Well of Souls from Raiders of the Lost Ark. Yeah, you know what's the thing is, I don't know if that many snakes have ever been assembled for real ever anywhere, so I don't know if we know what that sounds like.
Haven't
but I would...
you seen that
oh, sure.
Bananas Planet Earth episode?
No.
Or was that a Blue Planet episode? It was like one of the newer versions of Planet Earth.
You mean where they're chasing the lizard?
Yes.
I love that scene.
It's so good.
The snakes are all Living. Chasing down what kind of lizard
was it? An iguana?
Was it an iguana?
I
think so.
I gotta look this up. Snake versus iguana, Planet Earth.
Oh, fantastic.
It's in Planet Earth. It's in Planet Earth 2. And yes, it's iguanas versus snakes. Anyway, sorry.
Do snakes, when they sprint snake style, do they make noise? You know, like they make a slippery noise?
I don't know. I feel like they always add sound effects to these things to make TV more compelling.
It's all right,
like
well,
Foley or something.
It's not a bunch of snakes. It's not, but you had me at Raiders. All right, so
well, hopefully.
Nicholas Underwood said, hey, my dude, I love that. Hey, my dude. It must be a set of New Year's Eve crowd sounds superimposed upon each other. It must. That's what's up, Shifty Nick. Not correct, but you hit upon something in yours that you will come to see why. Another listener named Glenn Wilson wrote in and said, Uncle Bob, oops, I mean Jay. Uncle Bob, I think this week's noisy sounds like a curling rock. A curling rock. What does this? What do the curling rocks sound like when they get slid across ice, right?
I didn't know they were called curling rocks. I thought they were like pucks.
I thought they were curling stones.
Huh.
Maybe Glenn doesn't actually know himself. He is from Calgary, so he might know because he's up in that region. But let him email us and let us know. But that's not correct, but I would like to hear what that sounds like. There's actually something special about this. Let me play it for you again. You hear the echo?
Yeah.
Now let me play you another version of it. Does that sound familiar to you?
So is that like a funeral
dirge? The opening
dirge?
Of our show.
Right.
Oh. Is it a funeral dirge?
All right. So what? The second thing, what I just played for you is a less complicated version of the actual noisy. What this is, the second sound that I played for you is every single show from 2020 lined up by the song that we play, right? So the first note of the songs are all lined up. And that is a chorus of Steve doing an intro, and then it slides into our hellos. Now listen again.
Oh, my God.
Now, you know what I find interesting? You can hear everybody's voice in there.
Yeah.
I can hear Kara. I can hear Bob. No way. I can hear Evan. Yeah, because we're all talking. Now, the original one was hundreds of SGU, not 52, Hundreds. Now, I thought of this and I thought of Bob at the same time. How cool would it be if you could listen to 52 episodes at the same time and absorb them? You know what I mean? Like, you know, some AI can pick it out and hear it. You know, that one, maybe one day some humans will be able to do stuff like that. But anyway, I thought that was really cool. And I'd like to thank Robert who sent it in. And there's something about Robert. I found out that Robert is considered what, like the super Aussie or something like that. Anyway, Robert, thank you. It was really cool. He wrote a piece of software that, you know, managed this. He didn't do it by hand. He had a software run in, line everything up and pull it out. And I have different versions that he made for me, but I only had time to play the one. But thank you so much. That was a lot of fun. So we have a new Noisy for you this week. This Noisy was sent in by a listener named Scott Bringlow. Bringlow. So what was that? This one is, so far, I think it's my favorite Noisy of 2021. It's the only Noisy of 2021. No, but I really like this one. When you find out what it is, I think you'll find it very interesting. So if you think you know what this week's Noisy is, or if you heard something cool anywhere, in your basement, on TV, whatever, you email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Steve, as we sit here right now, 2 weeks and 2 days from now is the 12-hour patron thank you show.
Say what?
Wow. That's right.
Thank you.
We just had a big SGU meeting before the taping of this podcast. And
it took 12 hours.
Yes. We went through the entire show exactly the way we're going to do it.
That's right.
No, but it's fun because we get to throw a lot of ideas. You know, we have 12 hours to fill up. You know, everybody's bringing something to the table that they came up with. And George is coming up with a bunch of stuff. George, I always love this when George texts me and he's like, I came up with some bits. I'm like, oh, my God, I can't wait. Because, you know, you never know what George is going to do. It could be literally anything with that guy. Very excited. It's going to be a lot of fun. This is our patron thank you for the wonderful support that our patrons have shown us. This is a part of our Patreon. So if you're interested, you can go check out our Patreon with the other goals that we have on there. Steve likes to flaunt this one that we have a 24-hour show scheduled when we get to a certain number of patrons.
5,000.
You could, yes, 5,000.
That feels low to me, Steve.
It does to me too.
Nope, that's it.
We're at 4,400 right now.
Yeah, we're at 4,416 as
close.
Of right now, Kara.
Too close. Way too close to 5,000.
So if you're a patron of the SGU, please do join us because this is for you. And if you're not a patron of the SGU, come anyway because this is just going to be a lot of fun. We have a ton of people that are going to come visit. We have just so many different things going on, of course, because it's 12 hours. And it's not just the Skeptic's Guide. It's going to be, you know, like other stuff, lots of other things that you've never seen us do before. So you should check it out. 11 a.m. Eastern time to 11 p.m. Eastern time. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I don't know how did you convince me to type the words into our Patreon that says 12-hour live streaming, 24-hour live streaming? I mean, Steve.
I used the Jedi mind trick on you.
Like, why do you love it so much? I, you know, really.
I like to see you all squirm. All right. A couple of questions and emails. First, some corrections. So a number of people pointed out that the science fiction last week, you guys remember, was about the calendar?
Yes.
And one of the items was about the slowing of the Earth's rotation over time. And they said, well, that would affect the length of the day, not the year. And they are correct. Fortunately, that was the fiction.
Mm.
And so none of it matters to whether or not it was a fiction. But I did mean day and wrote year by mistake. And I think you all kind of knew that.
Yeah, I think I kind of mentally calculated
knew it was day
instead of year.
Yeah, you did. That's why, like, we discussed it as if it was day, but I wrote year because it was a brain fart. The Earth slows down its rotation over time so that we gain 2.5 milliseconds per century is the real answer. But that's the day, not the year. Evan,
yes.
A lot of people wrote in to point out that you may have done better on your predictions for 2020 than you gave yourself credit for.
I know. I should know better than just to rely on one source for my information.
Oh, Evan.
that'll get you every time, and it certainly got me.
But
had I done a little more research, I would have found that not only did two leaders of countries resign in 2020, but there were more, including the Prime Minister of Japan, the Prime Minister of Kyrgyzstan, and in Peru as well, the president was impeached by Congress. Hmm. So there was at least three, certainly five. I would have been more accurate if I said five, but my third prediction, basically we're going to now give me full credit for that particular one.
So that's really a high probability prediction because that happens every year probably.
It's going to just knock you down as soon as you're all puffed up, huh, Evan?
But it was also a specific prediction, unlike an earthquake will happen somewhere.
Yeah.
So I'd like a little more credit than, say, those kinds of predictions. And then also another listener pointed out that, well, I'll read it to you. Evan's prediction about credit card companies being hacked was correct. The news about the SolarWind hack has focused only on the government being part of the hack, but 18,000 companies in the world were part of the hack, and even Evan's predictive detail about 1 billion customers of information, their information being compromised, that turned out to be correct. So I'll take that, if you guys will join me in agreeing. And
hell yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So I was basically two for three out of my predictions. You get back to me and let me know, Bob, because it's important. I don't want to lose sleep. And of course, my prediction about problems with the Olympics in Japan didn't happen because the Olympics didn't happen. And therefore, I'm revising it for the upcoming Olympics in 2021 in Japan. Let's see if it happens then. I hope not, because it has to do with an earthquake, and let's hope that doesn't come true.
Okay.
Okay.
We got a number of emails about this. I'm just going to read one at random. This comes from Alex in Wilmington, North Carolina. Hey, I'm a big fan of the show, and I've listened for a few years. I just recently became a patron of the show. Thank you, Alex.
Awesome.
I just wanted to reach out to share something with you guys in regards to the small ad lib segment you did for the January 2nd, 2021 show, when Kara brought up the way to figure out your porn names, the name of your first pet, and street you were born on. I got a kick out of it, and you guys all clearly did. I just thought it would be worth mentioning that the reason for those two life attributes were originally used to determine your porn name was so that people would happily divulge two answers to security questions that some people choose to answer on higher security websites. All that being said, you may have never used those before, but now that those answers are out in the interweb, maybe don't use those in the future. Thanks for making a great show, and I look forward to seeing if your predictions for 2021 come true. Okay, thank you, Alex. So a number of people did point that out to us. So I did a semi-deep dive on this question because I think it's an intriguing point, but I wanted to know if it's actually true. Was the whole "this is how you figure out your porn star name" meme developed by people fishing for your security question answers?
My guess is no.
That would be my guess.
My guess is it was a fun thing that kids came up with.
So the results of my research are inconclusive. So it's clear that the porn star name meme predates the interwebs. So it certainly wasn't part of any modern phishing scam. But that doesn't mean that it's never been used as a phishing scam, right? I don't think it was invented as one, but it may have been used as one, although I couldn't find any documentation that it actually was. Most of the people warning about it, and there's a lot of security websites that warn about it, are warning about the potential for it to be used as a way of getting your social engineering, your passwords and security questions. And that is true. So the warning, I think, still holds. I just don't know that I don't think it originated as such a scam, and it certainly and I also don't know if it's ever actually been used that way, but it certainly could be. So the bottom line is those websites that use answers to security questions like "what was your mother's maiden name," whatever, that's crappy security anyway.
And maybe don't answer "what was the street you grew up on and the name of your first pet."
Yeah, but here's the thing. What security sites tell you to do, which makes sense, is when you do get those questions, you should lie. You should give a fake answer. Of course, you have to remember the fake
answer. It has to be a consistent lie. Yep.
It should be something that you're pretty sure you're going to remember, but it shouldn't be anything that exists in the real world. Because even without you divulging this information as your porn star name, then people can easily find this information.
Yeah, like your mom's maiden name?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's trivial.
Or what high school you went to,
totally,
your high
school
easy. Mascot. You could find
but
that
But the
out.
Part that frustrates me is when the security questions are subjective. Like, who's your favorite actor? And I'm like, will that still be the same person in 3 years?
I know.
Will I ever
here's
remember
the point.
What's your favorite book?
Point
am I going to remember
put in
my
anything
answer?
You want. Right. You could put in ZY247. It doesn't, it, you know,
but you have to
it doesn't
remember
matter.
That
it's just
you
a series
that.
Of characters. Well, that's why you're supposed to keep a written, not online, a written diary Ugh. Of your passwords and your codes. And that's what we recommend to our clients for our accounting services when they ask us about these questions, because it does come up quite often. And we tell them, go analog with that stuff.
Yeah.
What happens totally. If you lose
and,
that?
And on top of that, if you keep it somewhere safe, keep it, you know, with your important paperwork and those documents and things, but also make sure one other person you absolutely trust knows where to find it. Or if you're going to lock it in a safe deposit box or do something extreme like that, make sure at least one other person you trust knows about it.
It's so interesting. So I get the concern about wanting to have like a box with papers, important papers, but I don't know. Do you think that's a generational thing? Because nothing I have is on paper. I don't have like a lockbox with like
you have a birth certificate.
You don't have a fire safe in your
house? I don't. I have one birth certificate and one passport, and that's it.
How about your social security card?
It's in my wallet.
Well, yeah, okay, we'll do that.
What's in your wallet?
Yeah.
All right. But guys, I did come across a website that will tell you what your robot name would be if you were a robot.
Okay.
And all you have to to type in your social security number followed by your bank routing number. And when you do that, you get it turns it into this fun robot number name. You should do it.
It's really totes.
Fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll get right on that, brother.
They want my bank account routing number too. Funny.
Yeah.
Okay.
So whatever. Lovely. So I would be aware of things. Like certainly don't divulge this information on internet sites, but also don't use that information as your layer of security because they could be found out very easily anyway, is the bottom line. All right, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake, and then I challenge my panelists to tell me which one is the fake. It's still a slow news week, I find. There's so much like COVID news and then not much of anything else. So I did another theme this week. The theme is plant evolution.
All right, I got
it. Evolution of plants.
I know all the answers.
We don't talk a lot about. And I honestly don't know nearly as much about as I know about animal evolution, so I thought it'd be good to cover it. Okay, here we go. Item number 1, all land plants derive from a common terrestrial ancestor, which was a green algae. Item number 2, the first seed-bearing plants were cycads, palm tree-like gymnosperms that are still extant as a group today. And item number 3, the first trees appeared around 419 million years ago, consisted of multiple columns around a hollow trunk and connected by soft tissue, and have no living descendants. I'm going to describe that third one a little bit for you because it took me a couple of tries to get a mental image of what they were describing when I was reading it. So instead of a single trunk, imagine a ring of trunks around a hollow core, and that ring of trunks, it's one tree, right? But it's not one column that is the trunk. It's like multiple columns, as if there's like multiple trunks around a hollow core. And then they're all connected like chain link by soft tissue and filled in the middle by soft tissue. Does that make sense? Jay, you seem to be enthusiastic, so you can go first.
All right, the first one here. All land plants derive from a common terrestrial ancestor, which was a green algae. You know, my gut is saying that this is true. It just makes a lot of sense. You know, common ancestor. There had to be the first. But I would think also that it's possible that the ocean, a lot of different types of plant-like things developed in the ocean, you know, like seaweed or whatever it would have been back then. And then, you know, multiple plants could have come out of the ocean in one way or another. So that one's on hold right now. Next one, the first seed-bearing plants were cycads. Cycads. Palm tree-like gymnosperms. You know what that means, Bob? That's when you have sex in a gymnasium.
Yes.
No, it's when you don't have sex, Jay. It's gym.
No sperms. No. That's right. You just work out. You're just working out and you don't get to have sex with anyone. That are still extant as a group today. Ooh.
Extant.
I know what that means. Yeah, I mean, yeah, sure. I see no reason why that one couldn't be true, too. The last one, the first trees appeared around 419 million years ago, consisted of multiple columns around a hollow trunk and connected by a soft tissue and have no living descendants. So now you're saying that there is a tree that existed that no longer exists, has no descendants. That's very sad. All right. I'm going to say that all plants do not come from a common ancestor. Because the ocean is too huge and there would have been too much plants growing in the ocean to not have some of them move out of the ocean. So that one's the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, what the hell? I'll say that the that funky tree, I'll say that's fiction. I think you made that up. But that said, I can imagine that that's how it could have happened. You know, basically it's like a negative tree. You know, there's trunk where there's today is no trunk. And there's no trunk where there's trunk today. It's the opposite. So I think he just made that up. Fiction.
Okay, Kara.
Land plants derive from a common terrestrial ancestor, which was green algae. Terrestrial ancestor. I do think that all plants derived from algae. And I don't know what you're talking about, Jay, in terms of ocean plants. I do not know of these ocean plants. I know of plants that float in like ponds and stuff, but in the ocean, you're mostly just seeing colonial algae, like kelp. It's not a plant.
Don't even, Kara.
So this one kind of speaks to me. Gymnosperms. I know gymnosperms are complex. And when I think of cycads, I think of pictures of dinosaurs. Because I think they're like ferny, right? Aren't they ferny? I used to work in the science research building and it was right next to the evolutionary plant biologist. And I always saw their posters on the walls. But I don't know what the first seed-bearing plant would be. And then the first trees appeared around 419 million years ago. That's a long time ago. I thought this was all just like, I don't know, just ferns and stuff back then. Multiple columns around a hollow trunk connected by soft tissue. That's like a second concept. And then no living descendants. So would they really be trees? Or was it like the first tree-like thing? Because if it was actually a tree, wouldn't more trees have come from it? If it was the first evolutionary offshoot and then it died off, why would we define that as a tree? I'm going to say number two is the fiction, only because it sounds pretty amazing that one of the first things to evolve within a group is also extant now. I would think that maybe it would have died off. And also now you're not sweeping us.
Okay. And Evan, yes, Evan, they're all over the place, so no help to you.
Oh, boy. Steve, can you help me out on the first one here about all land plants derived from a common terrestrial ancestor? Terrestrial, do I take that as of the land?
Yep.
In other words, not out of the ocean?
That's right. No, but what that essentially means is land plants evolved once, right? And Jay's point was, well, plants from the ocean could have migrated to the land more than once, in which case that would not be true. So that's really the question. There's two parts to this. Did land plants only evolve once? And two, did they come from green algae, right? So those are the two things that could make it wrong.
Jay's compelling there, but I have a feeling Kara's correct in that the cycads one is going to be the fiction. I guess I'll have to go with Kara and say the cycads one is the fiction.
Okay,
I wouldn't be surprised if the first one was fiction.
All right, no hedging your bets. All right, yeah. So you're all spread out. So in those cases, I'll usually take them in order. So we'll start with number one. All land plants derive from a common terrestrial ancestor, which was a green algae. Jay, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is science. So it is true that land plants evolved once and that they evolved from green algae. The notion is that they evolved from green algae in ponds and the ponds would dry up, you know, and then they adapted to become progressively more tolerant to not being in water, and then spread out from there across the land. And once that happened, they took over. There was really no, they took over the, all the,
talk
the
about
space
no competition.
On land, I guess, and there was no room. Yeah, there was no, yeah, no space for other plants to do that. And yeah, it was a green algae. So all land plants are evolved from green algae. What's interesting is that green algae and red algae adapted to the land. And the green algae is the one that led to all other land plants. Imagine if the red algae had won out.
Yeah, weird. And,
oh boy.
Yeah, the plant, we could have a red planet instead of a green planet in terms of vegetation.
But would we know the difference, or would it just look the same to us?
Well, we would have adapted. Our entire evolutionary, like our visual adaptation would have been based around red plants, which is so weird.
Yeah.
Probably would have looked, it would look different, but we would, it would be usual, be normal for us.
It'd be normal to
similar. Us. Yeah. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. See, you're agreeing with
Wasn't
me.
Wasn't there a planet on one of those new Star Trek movies that had sort of red plants everywhere?
Why not?
It was wild looking.
To us.
All right. Let's go to number two. The first seed-bearing plants were cycads, palm tree-like gymnosperms that are still extant as a group today. Evan and Carrie, you think this one is the fiction. Bob and Jay, you think this one is science. And this one is the fiction.
Yes.
Good job, guys.
Oh. Thanks, Kara. You saved me.
So cycads were around in the Jurassic period,
right, so
and they're still around today.
I saw them with dinosaurs. I was right.
Yeah, okay. They were with dinosaurs, and they are still around today, but they weren't the first seed-bearing plants. The first seed-bearing plants, you were getting close there, Kara. They were ferns, and they were so-called seed ferns.
Oh, wait, but so cycads aren't ferns.
No.
They're palm tree-like.
Palm tree. So, you know, like, you've ever seen those, like, it looks like a bulb and then, like, the palm tree leaves coming out the top kind
sure,
of
yeah,
thing.
Yeah.
Like a paintbrush.
So they also, they produce seeds, and those seeds are eaten by native people in certain tropical areas. And then also they can contain neurotoxins. So don't do that.
Oh, okay. Good to know.
Yeah, there was a cluster of ALS that was caused by bats eating cycads and people eating the bats getting a concentrated neurotoxin. Yeah. What was the first seed-bearing plants were ferns. Ferns were basically your first big group of land plants, you know, evolved from that algae is the ferns before the conifers evolved and other things evolved. And the seeds were an adaptation to dry land, you know, that surviving. So before seeds, how did plants reproduce?
Panspermia.
Did they just do the thing like a propagation?
Like it floated through the air.
Like vegetative propagation where they just split and grow.
Some did that, but they also had sexual propagation through spores. They just released male and female spores.
That's what I just said.
And
I would assume that was a newer evolution than an older one.
No, spores are older.
Okay.
Yeah, spores are older. And then those spores evolved into, the male spores evolved into pollen and the female spores into seeds. And it's just a way, and the dual adaptation there is that it protects them and keeps them moist, but also provides nutrition for them so that they have some ready calories when they germinate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But other than that, they just would spread their spores everywhere and hope that a couple landed next to each other. So it was definitely an evolutionary adaptation improvement. Okay. The first trees appeared around 419 million years ago, consisted of multiple columns around a hollow trunk and connected by soft tissue, and have no living descendants. That is science. So in this definition, a tree, you know, has a woody trunk, basically. And so this is cool. So they were, and the artist's impression of the trees makes them look like truffula trees. I don't think that was intentional, but they're cool looking. But their trunk is really a ring of smaller trunks connected like a chain link fence, you know, with soft tissue in between. And as they grow, each of the individual columns grows, which kind of splits apart the trunk. And then it has to repair itself by filling it in with the soft tissue.
And that's how it gets big?
That's how it gets bigger. They said they can get to 8 to 12 meters tall. That's pretty big. These are the cladoxylopsids. Cladoxylopsids is the name of the... Yep. So yeah, so it's pretty cool. And they were out, I guess, competed by the modern trees, you know, the conifers with a single central trunk rather than the ring of outer trunks.
It's kind of weird then that they still define it as a tree if it was an evolutionary dead end. Like, is like,
yeah,
a
but it was not. Tree is not a cladistic group, obviously. Yeah. So tree, as I said, tree defined as having a woody trunk. So, yeah.
I hate taxonomy so much.
I know. It's like a nut is not a cladistic thing either. It's like saying, calling it a nut.
Oh, like a peanut or a cashew or an almond. Yeah, they're all different. Beans, legume. Yeah, whatever.
It's yeah. Confusing.
And is a taco a sandwich, really?
Is a taco a sandwich? So I get your confusion, but yeah.
We'll put two
again,
of them together.
Imagine if these things were the ones that survived. These would be our trees, and we would take it for granted that this is trees. And so definitely the first forests were of these guys, right? That would be so cool. I love just imagining like alien ancient landscapes with completely bizarre plants and animals. Love it. I've always, ever since I was a kid.
Yeah, that's why I've always loved sci-fi movies that show really creative and distinctive alien plants instead of, oh, look, they look just like our trees.
Right. And if you're in the past, you have ferns, right, Kara? That's just basically, that's how you know you're in the past. There's ferns everywhere.
There's ferns everywhere. Yeah. And dinosaurs.
But it was true. There was ferns everywhere at some point. Like, I'm pretty good at understanding of, like, when the different vertebrate groups arose and what's related to what, et cetera. But not nearly as well developed an internal model for plant evolution.
Well, and it's even hard for us taxonomically to distinguish different types of plants when we look at them. Like, for some of us, it's really hard to know. Those two things could be evolutionary distinct by so much time. Or, like, that plant over there is, like, octoploidy, and that one has, like, 16 sets of genes. And we just, it's just unfathomable.
I think that's true. And, in fact, like, when Linnaeus came up with his taxonomy, plants were basically put into groups based upon their morphological, you know, description, like how
Where
many stains they have and things like that.
Are their leaves pointy? Are they more like pines?
Exactly.
Or needles,
and they had nothing to do with their evolutionary relationships, pretty much. And so, it's completely non-evolutionary. Cladistic taxonomy is different than Linnaean taxonomy for animals too, but I think it was a lot more intuitive and a lot closer. Plants were like, it was like almost no relationship. So I think that you're right. Like the plant evolutionary relationships are less intuitive to us than animals are.
Yeah.
Because we ain't a plant.
I agree with that. All right. Evan, give us a quote.
Science and secrecy do not sit comfortably together. In technologically advanced democracies, it is almost an article of faith that openness is essential for both the advancement of science and for its beneficial interaction with society. And that was written by Sheila Jasanoff. She's a professor of science and technology studies at the Harvard Kennedy School.
Totally agree with that.
Yep.
Secrecy is anathema to science.
Absolutely.
Science, yeah, it can't function unless it is an open exchange of ideas and information, and also has to be done in good faith. Science done in bad faith is pseudoscience, basically.
Yeah.
Exactly. Correct. Yeah. Yep, we talk about it often.
All right. Well, thank you guys for joining me. This was our first regular episode of the year.
You got it, man. I'm looking forward to it.
Good to be regular with you.
Yep. And we'll continue to do the Friday afternoon live streams. And we're looking forward to the January 23rd 12-hour show.
Yes.
So hopefully you'll be able to join us for that as well. All right, guys. Thanks again. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.